Welcome to The Source Podcast, powered by WHYY News and Billy Penn. This collection of stories from the WHYY Newsroom offers fresh insights into the neighborhoods and local communities across the Philadelphia region. From Center City to the Pennsylvania suburbs, South Jersey, and Delaware, get to know the issues and the people that make your community tick. This is The Source. I'm your host, Kenny Cooper. Childhood obesity has been growing at a staggering rate. Today, nearly 1 in 4 children are considered obese. Changes in diet and exercise can help some overweight kids, but it's not enough for others who already have diabetes, sleep apnea, and other serious health issues. Weight loss surgery could be an option. Research shows it's safe and effective for kids with severe obesity, but less than 1% of adolescents get it. WHYY's Nicole Leonard has more.
Charisse Coy Armour and her son Brian are relaxing in the living room. They just got back from speech therapy. Brian is 16 and has Down syndrome.
Brian, what's your favorite activity?
At school.
At school?
Yeah.
He does love school. He's in 11th grade. He really enjoys school.
Brian also enjoys track and field and boxing classes, but that's a newer development. During the pandemic, Coy Armour says he started gaining weight rapidly.
He just was getting bigger, and he's getting bigger wide, not bigger tall.
Brian eventually weighed just under 200 pounds, a lot for a teen who was just over 4 feet tall. Kids with Down syndrome are at a higher risk for obesity than their peers. The weight affected his health. He had less energy for activities. In track and field, he mostly did shot put, even though he really didn't like it.
Because that's normally what they have, like, bigger people doing, like the kind of overweight people.
Brian also had trouble walking to the park with family and friends. At one point, his health insurance approved a wheelchair for him to use.
Well, as I'm seeing our life play out, I don't want him in a wheelchair because of weight. It's different if he can't walk. I don't want him in a wheelchair because of he's overweight.
Coy Armour and Brian then started going to the weight management clinic at Nemours Children's Health in Delaware. They learned about healthy eating, portion control, and nutrition. But soon it became clear diet changes alone weren't going to work. So they tried adding a GLP-1 medication. It was a daily injection.
Which is rough. For me to have to give him an injection every day, it started to hurt him and then he would get upset. And I don't want to upset him. I want him to feel comfortable.
As Brian's weight continued to hover just under 200 pounds, Coy Armour started asking about weight loss surgery. She knew it would come with some risks, like any surgery, but it felt worth it.
Weight will turn into a health concern. And I just, on top of him already being developmentally delayed, the world is hard enough. So I don't want to give him anything else to make it harder.
The clinic at Nemours Children's sees kids with all stages of obesity. Treatment always includes counseling and therapy around diet and exercise. For some kids, those lifestyle changes will be enough to help them reach a healthy weight. But it won't for others, especially kids already experiencing serious weight-related health issues.
If they have severe comorbidities already, like diabetes, like liver disease, like sleep apnea.
That's Dr. Kirk Reichard. He's a pediatric general surgeon at Nemours.
I mean, we have a lot of kids that come in that are on CPAP already, and they're 14 years old. That's a problem.
Conversations about additional obesity treatment usually start with medications that can suppress appetite. At this point, health providers also gently introduce the idea of metabolic and bariatric surgery, because Reichard knows the word surgery can be a scary thing for most families.
There's no question that it is still considered a lot for a kid. You know, how do you approach a family who's calling a new patient who's 14 and has severe obesity? Do you ask them up front? Are they interested in bariatric surgery? Many of them will say, no, no way.
But not bringing up the option at all has downsides, he says. Because when obese kids become obese adults, they're at a much higher risk of heart attacks, pregnancy complications, strokes, and other serious chronic diseases. In that context, surgery no longer seems so extreme, Reichard says.
There's just no justification anymore to wait until adulthood for this. And that was what people said, wait till they're adults. Well, We know how that goes.
Long-term research shows that these procedures are safe in teens. Complications are rare, and kids tend to recover better than adults, data shows. The American Academy of Pediatrics updated its guidelines on childhood obesity in 2023. They now say that medication and surgical treatment options should be offered earlier, alongside diet and lifestyle changes. Still, less than 1% of obese adolescents end up getting surgery. Reichard says there's a lot of work to be done in educating families about this option. Charisse Cuellar Moore says she got some pushback from family and friends on her decision to have her son Brian undergo weight loss surgery, but she felt confident.
I want what's best for him before anybody else. So I'm not going to put him in something that's going to possibly kill him. You know what I mean? I know success stories. I know people who have had weight loss surgery and took off, never was to be overweight again. That's what I want for him.
A cussy.
Yeah, you're crazy.
Brian had a sleeve gastrectomy on July 31st, 2024. The operation didn't have any complications. Since then, he's learned which foods make him feel good and which ones don't. Cuellar Moore has a say in most of what Brian eats, but she still wants him to make healthy choices of his own and enjoy food.
Now we go to the Amish market and they bake the cookies fresh and he gets one chocolate chip cookie a day. That's his reward.
Yeah, right? Yes, right.
That's right.
Yes, that's right.
That's right. So now he gets it now. So now I don't even have to tell him what he can't have or what he shouldn't have. He knows.
Over a year and a half after surgery, Brian's weight is under 130 pounds. And at track practice, he's now running alongside his classmates. Nicole Leonard, WHYY News.
A recent poll found that 1 in 8 Americans have taken a GLP-1 drug, which makes people have less of an appetite. So now, some restaurants in Philadelphia are offering smaller portions of their dishes. This is something obesity researchers have long called for to reduce overeating. WHYY's Alan Yu has more.
When you step into the restaurant Cuba Libre in Philadelphia's Old City, it feels a bit like you're walking into a Cuban courtyard. Wrought iron balconies overlook the main floor. Weathered shutters and old windows mimic vintage Cuban architecture. Palm trees create a tropical atmosphere, and paddle fans turn overhead. And of course, the food matches the setting.
This is a traditional Cuban dish, ropa vieja. Translates literally to old clothes.
Executive chef Guillermo Veloso is showing me around the kitchen.
So basically, we're letting the meat absorb the juice and get a little thick. We'll serve that with grilled asparagus.
This is not their regular ropa vieja. It still has the traditional beef brisket, bell peppers, tomatoes, and onions, but it also has the added asparagus, and the portions are smaller. This version has half the amount of rice and Cuban black beans, 3 ounces instead of 6. The chefs here worked with a local physician to design this dish, and several others, for people who are on GLP-1 drugs.
Reduce fat, reduce portion size, fiber included because it's an important part of the diet as well.
It started when two customers who are friends of restaurant owner Barry Gutten asked for a special menu to accommodate their dietary needs. That GLP-1 menu is now available to all diners. But Gutten says the restaurant also added smaller portions of some dishes to their regular menu because there are people who want to eat less, even if they are not on GLP-1 drugs.
Seniors tend to eat smaller. Smaller people tend to eat smaller. And we see that they wanted a variety in terms of portion size and also in price.
He says it's hard to say right now whether the smaller portions are a success, but they are thinking about featuring smaller versions of more dishes in the future.
It has benefits for the guests who are eating lighter in a number of ways. It's at a lower price. They don't feel bad that they're leaving leftovers from a larger portion.
Reduced portion sizes is something that health policy researcher Sophia Hua has been thinking about for a long time.
I just think it's such a powerful way to get people to not overeat, because the great thing about smaller portions is that you're still able to eat what you want to eat, right? You're not telling people that they can't eat a certain thing or something is banned from a specific diet. It's that you can eat it, just eat it in smaller amounts, which people don't like to hear.
She's at the University of Pennsylvania. She says it's promising that restaurants are starting to offer smaller portions, though it's not clear if this will actually lead to people eating less.
Now that they're calling it lighter portions, are people going to think, well, I'm not going to be full if I order from a lighter portion, even if the calories are sufficient to fill someone up?
She did a recent field experiment where she got two university cafes to introduce a smaller version of existing dishes, as well as the regular size. She found that people did buy the smaller and cheaper version when offered. She says that shows two things. Just presenting a smaller option can help people to eat less, and that a restaurant can do this without losing money.
Even when these cafes offered that smaller portion for a lower price, it didn't affect their bottom line.
Cuba Libre in Philadelphia is not the only restaurant getting on board this trend either. Big chains like Olive Garden and the Cheesecake Factory also started offering smaller portions of some of their regular dishes. Alan Yu, WXRY News.
Think about the shingles on your home. Are they made of asphalt, aluminum, wood? Imagine if those shingles were made of food waste, pineapple peels, eggshells, and shrimp shells. From the WHYY News Climate Desk, Susan Phillips reports on a group of Penn researchers who are designing building materials that could be healthier for us and the planet.
We're standing beneath the South Street Bridge in Philadelphia, and right next to it, below street level, is a triangular-shaped farm staffed by Penn students and run by Emily Fleshman.
So right here you can see we have two beds of spinach, bok choy, garlic that we've overwintered.
At the end of the growing season, after the tomatoes and eggplants and sunflowers have been harvested, the inedible parts of the plant, stalks and leaves and vines, would typically go into the compost bin. But here, that waste will be turned into building materials. Fleshman and her fellow farmers use the dusty area beneath this bridge to dry these stalks for about 3 weeks. Today, they are moving them off drying racks and will soon cart them across campus to the Dumo Lab, run by architect Laia Moga Soldevila.
You can come. You'll see we are overflowing everywhere with waste. The waste takes a lot of space.
Here at the Dumo Lab is where the farms of the future meet the buildings of the future.
This is all our farm collection classified with different plant sources. This is the fruit of sorghum, right, Yasaman?
Yeah.
The flower part.
Research assistant Yasaman Amirzeni takes the discarded farm waste, along with pineapple skins from a campus cafeteria, mango peels from street vendors, and eggshells from a pharmaceutical company, dries them out even further, and grinds them into a fine powder. In Philadelphia, food waste like this accounts for about 17% of the city's total waste stream, meaning it ends up in a landfill or incinerator. But here at the Dumo Lab, the researchers hope to solve multiple problems at once. Keep food waste out of the landfills and incinerators. Make healthier building materials like shingles that could be on your house. And tackle climate change.
Concrete and technical ceramics that are very energy intensive.
The construction industry also accounts for 34% of global carbon dioxide emissions, according to the UN. Concrete, steel, aluminum, and plastics are responsible for a large amount of greenhouse gases, primarily because it takes a lot of fossil fuels to produce them. But here in the lab, they're using stuff that usually gets thrown in the garbage. All this food waste becomes a composite that does not need to be fired or cured. Moga Soldevila says it goes right into a mold or 3D printer.
Then the last part of the process is to coat this with natural waxes or natural oils.
What's more, Amirzeni says the finished products maintain the original scent of the dried food scraps, primarily pineapple or mango.
Celery smells awesome. Like, it's really strong.
Oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm.
In addition to the climate benefits, these shingles will not leach chemicals into the environment or cause indoor air pollution from toxic off-gassing, which is a problem with a lot of modern building materials. Instead, Moga Soldevila says they actually leach minerals that help the soil.
When rain washes off of these materials, it gets nutrients instead of nasty chemicals to the ground.
Right now, the team is experimenting and testing these natural materials against architectural safety standards to see if they can stand up to more common materials like plastics or concrete.
And that's why we want as much waste and as much different streams as possible, because different plants are more porous, more fibrous, better at flexibility, better at compression.
While the lab is located at Penn's Fine Arts Building, it's interdisciplinary, merging engineering, chemistry, physics, biology, and problem-solving design into what they see as the future of buildings.
The biomaterials revolution is coming, and we all need to be prepared to be able to deliver materials that are healthier, that can biodegrade naturally, and then still perform the same way concrete performs, the same way technical ceramics perform.
Moga Soldevila proudly shows another experiment, an arch made of shrimp shells, sand, and flax fibers. The model is about 4 feet high in the center and 6 feet from end to end.
It's rock solid.
Yep.
Wow. And very thin, and that's why we're excited. Of course, it's calculated to be that thin, right? So there's a lot of structural optimization coming in because we try to use benign materials, but also the least amount of them.
Allison Mears is the co-founder of the Healthy Materials Lab at the Parsons School of Design in New York. Mears says one reason we have so many fossil fuel-based building materials is because they are cheap and can be mass-produced. She sees a future in agricultural waste because it's so prevalent.
The highest percentage of any kind of waste comes from agriculture. And that's where some of this really interesting building product development is happening. And you can start to see scale there and adoption in the use of products that are made from what we might have called waste products.
Moga Soldevila says it's inevitable that the future of buildings will be made from refurbished waste products, in part because of what's known as end of life. The advantage of natural materials is that when they wear out, they don't have to go to the landfill or the incinerator because they can decompose naturally. But that's not the case with traditional building materials like concrete and rebar.
Here, our rebar is fiber. That's how we can make a beam out of shrimp and straw, because we have a straw that's very good at bending, and we have shrimp shells that are very good at binding the straw to itself. So now we have a bending compressive material, which is what concrete and rebar does.
Moga Soldevila says there's no need to invent something new to solve many of our climate and environmental problems, because the answers lie all around us in nature. From the Climate Desk, I'm Susan Phillips, WHYY News.
From building materials made of food, we turn to plants that made America. What roles did the colony's flora and fauna play in America's nation building? As part of WHYY's celebration of America's 250th birthday, Peter Crimmins reports on two Philadelphia museums' quest to unravel the botanical roots of America.
When Thomas Jefferson arrived in Philadelphia to draft the Declaration of Independence, he was not impressed by the city. The gentleman farmer from Virginia saw America as an agrarian nation, so when he became president in 1801, he sent Meriwether Lewis and William Clark into the interior of the continent to discover the secrets of the nation's roots and plants.
Many Americans look to the Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery as a way to think about national identity. But it was much more complex than the story of these two heroic figures.
Marina McDougall is the curator of Botany of Nations at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University.
The object of the Corps of Discovery, the aims of it, were complicated. He actually asked Lewis and Clark in meeting with Native Americans to explore trade. So there was diplomatic interest, and the Native Nations came to it with their complex trade histories.
Botany of Nations is designed to correct the narrative of Lewis and Clark discovering the wilderness of the New World. In reality, That historic expedition encountered over 50 distinctive native nations with hundreds, even thousands of years of botanical knowledge and trading partnerships. Lewis and Clark attempted to identify the American continent through a European scientific method, naming and categorizing plant species. Before their expedition, they were trained in botany by Philadelphia's Dr. Benjamin Barton, who advocated for the creation of an encyclopedia of medicinal plants that were unique to the New World, an American pharmacopoeia.
So this is a real resource for a community. This is like WebMD, right, in your colonial era.
Meredith Sellers is the curator of revolutionary botany at the Mutter Museum. She says American physicians wanted to develop their own medicinal resources distinct from those of Europe.
That's really what the American pharmacopoeia reflects. It's a compendium of European known curatives, and then they're adding to it new American plants.
But the urgency to discover American plants came with fundamental flaws. Nakia Williamson Cloud, a member of the Nez Perce people, is one of several indigenous ethnobotanists who consulted on the Academy show. He says Lewis and Clark's effort to name and categorize species ran counter to indigenous practices.
We don't go discover a place. We go to a place and we seek connection with it. That's what gives us identity. We don't give it identity. So it's a whole different way of seeing yourself in relationship to land and resources.
Lewis and Clark sent 220 plant samples back to Philadelphia with descriptions, but the pair did not take notes on their cultural or spiritual uses, believing those would not be useful. Those samples are still in the Academy of Natural Sciences archive. Director of Development Caitlin O'Brien says the exhibit includes indigenous perspectives, which will now go into the permanent archived herbarium.
The Academy's been around for 200 plus years. What are researchers going to want in 50, 100, 200 years beyond that? They're going to want the full view of what a plant can tell us.
Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
In Philly's East Passyunk section, Juan Carlos Aparicio's award-winning Mexican restaurant, El Chingon, has made a hot spot out of this previously quiet and dark South Philly block when it arrived in mid-2020. It also put Aparicio's name on some of the most prestigious food award lists in the country, as a James Beard semifinalist for Best Chef, New York Times nod as one of America's 50 best restaurants, and most recently, a Michelin Bib Gourmand selection. WHYY photojournalist Kim Painter visited El Chingon to see what makes this such a welcoming place for everyone in the community.
We live above the restaurant, and it was something that we always see. The neighborhood was super dark. It was nothing. It was like very quiet. And for some reason, I just had that vision that, you know, opening this restaurant, it was going to light up specifically this corner. The migration, when it happens from Mexico to South Philly, we always wanted to represent our culture and evolving with South Philly and becoming part of South Philly has been one of the main reasons why I choose this location. We want to have a well-run restaurant where, you know, people come and enjoy and kind of unite the community between food, and that's what it's about. We always want to cook good food to bring families and friends together. We make everything in the house, from the semitas, from the sourdough flour tortillas, corn tortillas, and we always like to experiment with different combinations from different regions. We're not afraid putting a flavor from Puebla and a flavor from Sinaloa or flavor from the peninsula of Yucatan. Any chef in the city, we're always trying to keep the culture and that, you know, Romans sense of love and want to be united and want to be create more and more things for people to come together. Being part of the Michelin Guide has been super exciting, super, we weren't expecting it. And it's just been, you know, grateful and the community, the neighborhood has been amazing.
Thanks for joining us for The Source, powered by WHYY News and Billy Penn. We leave you with a Billy Pennism, a bit of wit and wisdom from Pennsylvania's founder, William Penn.
Time is what we want most, but what we use worst.
The Source is a production of WHYY News. I'm your host, Kenny Cooper. Our executive producer is Sarah Glover, WHYY's Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Our editor is Mark Eichmann, WHYY's News Director. Alan Chu is the audio editor. Our engineers are Charlie Kyer and Diana Martinez. Funding for this podcast has been provided by WHYY and the Linfest Institute for Journalism. Please rate and review this content wherever you get your podcast and share on social media. Visit WHYY.org for more news stories. Thanks for listening.